This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Korerotia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Kia ora, this is Speak Up Korerotia, a specialist human rights radio show and podcast. We cover topics as diverse as cultural identity, disability issues, gender, gender identity, international affairs, and like today's topic, the interrelationship between urban spaces and human rights. This is an area that fascinates me personally and which will only continue to increase in importance, I'm sure, as the world's population continues to grow and as our cities do as well. I'm Sally Carlton, your host, and today we're discussing collaborative urban living. I'm really pleased to introduce Jason Twill, Greer O'Donnell and Jane Quigley, who are our guests for today. It would be fantastic if you could all introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about what you do and why you're taking part in this conversation. Jason, maybe we'll start with you.
Yep, Jason Twill. I am from the U.S., as you can hear from my Yankee accent. Did a lot of development work in New York City. So my career over the last 20 years has really been defined by really pushing more social and ecologically responsible development models in cities, caring very much about how we build cities for the 99% and really focusing on equity and inclusion and accessibility for all people.
When you say for the 99%, what exactly do you mean?
I mean that cities can be for everybody, so we don't gentrify minority neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods, different ethnicities. That we're tolerant. Like, cities are places of tolerance and cultural melting and like reciprocity of cultures, so we can, that's why cities are great. And if they aren't for everybody, and you gentrify and focus on only high-end housing, high-end retail, high-end commercial, you kind of price out and you start to erode that culture and the values what cities have always been for, a place for humans to come together.
Nice idea.
It was a great idea.
Yeah, and you're here visiting Christchurch as part of your innovation fellow and job at the University of Technology in Sydney, is that correct?
Yeah, so I'm part-time at the University of Technology Sydney. I've been very grateful that they've offered me a position to kind of do some research there and teach kind of more equitable ways of looking at housing, alternative ways of housing and workplace models for cities. I do some research on new economic models that start to integrate how we can look at environmental value and social value differently and how we look at investing in places so we don't look at the hidden impacts we have on the society and the environment. And then I have Urban Apostles, which is my business where I focus on consulting and doing my own development. So I focus on deliberative housing models, which is co-housing and other forms of housing, which is non-speculative in nature. So we work with groups of people that want to have a certain more communal way of living for owner-occupied housing in cities.
Sounds fantastic. Jane, how about you?
Kia ora, I'm Jane Quigley, and I've been interested in community living for over 20 years. And I think it really stems from having lived in the country, farming in the first part of my adult life, having children, and having the neighbours be a five-minute drive away. And look, I thought it just there had to be something better, really. So I've actually probably nearly 20 years ago been quite active in bringing together eco-villages, but we now call them co-housing communities, which is very cool. And so just after the earthquakes, I called on some of my old friends who I'd been involved with the establishment of eco-villages. I called them together and said, hey, like, there's a real opportunity here to develop something in the centre of Christchurch. So we formed the Viva Project to support sustainable and community-focused development in the rebuild.
And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through.
Great.
Greer, I'm really pleased to hear you work for OHU, the Office of Holistic Urbanism. I particularly love your acronym, meaning to work collaboratively in te reo. I think that's awesome.
Yes, it's a very suited name for what we're trying to achieve. So I'm Greer O'Donnell. I have a number of interests in relation to the subject matter. Of probably the most relevance is the work that I'm doing with OHU Development, which is a development company that specialises in supporting communities to create and own their own assets that sustain them and the community which they belong to. I also have been researching into livability and what impacts our livability in New Zealand and how that's impacted by legislation and regulation that we currently have, and where there's areas of improvement. I've had a background in development, working with the government largely on the rebuild of Christchurch, and had an interesting perspective around development projects, which was very top-heavy and potentially missed out on the input that communities could have contributed. And I think that there's a real opportunity now in this next phase of Christchurch regeneration for the development of our city to be led by the people who reside in it. I think there's been a number of great moves made by the government in terms of committing large infrastructure projects, but what's now really important is the communities filling in the gaps between those what were termed anchor projects, because that's really where the life and the soul of cities comes from. Unlike the others, I've got a fascination in community co-housing, co-living arrangements. I myself grew up very closely associated with what some New Zealanders will remember as the OHU communities, also known as communes, that were developed in the 70s, having family that was involved in those communities and still very closely linked into those who now live in eco-villages up the Whanganui River. So I've also had a fascination in what it means to bring people together in living environments and the broad spectrum of those that we have in New Zealand, and very much looking to expand that into the urban form within cities and to explore how we can translate some of those more, usually more fringe communities into our central cities, and how we do that in terms of modern co-living in smaller spaces. So that's me.
Great. Well, my first question for all of you is, we've mentioned communes, eco-villages, co-housing. I noticed, Jason, in the talk you gave, you were talking about micro-neighbourhoods. Are these effectively the same sort of thing? And what exactly do we mean when we're talking about these sorts of terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at communal living, that's kind of how we always used to live. The kind of way we live now with nuclear families and kind of exploded around in cities and separate homes, not living with our parents and next generation, is unique in modern contemporary culture.
And I would argue in this particular Western culture too.
Correct, very Western culture, that's correct. That's a very good point. So as much we can learn from our Indigenous brothers and sisters out there on this different way of living. I'm heavily influenced by Native Americans, and I've been heavily influenced by having mentors in Indigenous Australians as well. But there's, you know, contemporary co-housing really kind of has its mark in Denmark. In late 1968, there was an article in a newspaper I shared the other night where it was some local person in Copenhagen writing about the importance of every child having 100 parents and how that, what that means to raising the next generation, having other male and female mentors in our lives as we grow up around society. And a group of 50 families took that literally and built one of the first contemporary co-housing projects in the world in Sattendammen. And that's an owner-occupied, very citizen-led development model where groups of peoples and families come together, get an architect, work with the local government and planning agencies, find land, and really co-create their own form of living that's much more sustainably minded, much more communally focused, much more shared equity, sweat equity, and financial equity, and how they want to live their lives, not just in private, isolated homes, but really connected to each other and sharing and helping each other. Now take that to what's happening in today's world with what I'll call this immune response with rapid urbanization and the disease of unaffordability in cities. You have this another generation coming up, you know, as echo boomers and millennials looking to do a very similar form of desiring that social cohesion and how we live, but taking into a contemporary urban context. And co-living is kind of just the millennial way of looking at co-housing, but not necessarily having ownership. So the co-living models that I'm seeing around the world, and Greer can probably shed some light on that, on her experience here, it's a generation that not necessarily want, and I'm not going to speak on behalf of the whole thing, it's not stereotyping them, but there's a large cohort you're seeing with this movement in co-living that they don't want to necessarily own a home. They want to have the experience of a place that they like to live in and love. They can pay a membership to be part of this group, community. And it's very new, so it hasn't been scaled and tested around the world, but it's a lot of people that are colonizing old buildings or figuring out new ways of living to make it affordable and accessible for them. So it's a kind of reinventing co-housing in a contemporary, dense, urban context.
Fantastic. Greer, have you got anything you'd like to add?
I guess I'd just build on what Jason's saying. A lot of the work that we're doing, the communities that have raised their heads when searching for a professional entity to help them are communities who very much are seeking a new way of doing things. They genuinely have lesser equity to invest, so they aren't able to buy their own home, but they also have less of a, as Jason mentioned, desire to necessarily own what they create a home in. So the notion of home ownership is definitely shifting. And a lot of the groups that have approached Oahu, especially in Auckland, are seeking to form groups where they can maximise what equity or what small amounts of money they can save to have a place that's a home, but that they share with others. And it's breeding more of a mutual reliance model. And how you translate that into the financial and the legal structures to enable that kind of development is really challenging. At the moment, we have traditional rent, build-to-rent models, which come out of Australia and are being applied here in New Zealand, but again, it's still speculative. It's still led by a developer. It hasn't been led by the people who will inhabit these spaces. So there isn't really a model that is easily replicated or shared between the groups who are interested. So I think there's a large amount of education and knowledge sharing before they're really the fruition. These projects are going to come to fruition at any scale. I know of some very small sort of 3 to 4 groups of people coming together, building townhouses side by side in the name of co-housing, but it still remains an individual dwelling with separate living habits, divisioned by those normal partitions and walls. So the actual community group ends up living individually, even though they came together to do the development. So I think there's still some way to go in New Zealand implementing a modern-day co-ownership model, and that's hopefully what we, through Oahu, will be able to fast-track this for people.
Cool, that sounds great. All right, well, we have unfortunately run out of time in our first segment. We're going to have Jane's choice of song, which is Jack Johnson's Reduce, Reuse, Recycle, the 3R song. Very appropriate for today's topic.
Three, it's a magic number. Yes, Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Because 2 times 3 is 6. And 3 times 6 is
18.
And the 18th letter in the alphabet is
R.
Yeah. We got 3 R's we're gonna talk about today. We gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Well, if you're going to the market to buy some juice, you gotta bring your own bags and you learn to reduce your waste. We gotta learn to reduce. And if your brother or your sister's got some cool clothes, you can try them on before you buy some more of those. Reuse. We gotta learn to reuse. And if the first 2 R's don't work out, and if you gotta make some trash, well, don't throw it out. Recycle. We gotta learn to recycle. We gotta learn to reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Reduce, reuse, recycle. Because 3, it's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
Speak up, Korerotia. You're listening to Speak Up, Korerotia. Jane, we're going to start with you this time. What are some of the benefits of collaborative and urban living?
Look, I agree with both Gria and Jason, what they've talked about. Really interesting, we've, just to jump off something that you said, Jason, about the co-housing communities in Denmark. Within the Viva project, we've studied these quite a lot, and also in North America. And there is quite quite a firm model to have to build successful co-housing communities. And, so I really don't want to reinvent the wheel regarding how much land to have, how many people to have involved in a co-housing community. Interestingly, I went to India at the beginning of this year for around a month and visited a lot of villages and did a bit of village outreach. And, of course, these people have lived in villages for eons, for thousands and thousands of years. So they've got villages down pat. But, like, what I noticed is I noticed something about the little children, like the babies were always carried either by a member of the extended family or the little children within the village. But they were happy. You know, they were poor, but they were happy. So, you know, like, I've come to live in the city from the country, and what I see is a lot of loneliness within the city. Like, how can we have that different? You know, how can we create something that supports everything? And you talked about that, Jason, too. So that's what we're about within Viva. You know, having happy, loving communities.
That really resonates with me, Jane, because I think in a world where we're so socially connected through all of these platforms, there's a real disconnectedness between our communities and our people, and especially across generations.
Yeah.
So the building on the notion of it takes a village is we've compartmentalised people into your children and you do this, your middle youthful teens and you behave like this, you know, you're young professionals and you should live like this, and you're old people and you should live like that. And actually what these co-housing projects do is they offer an opportunity to break down the barriers. I'm particularly interested in the intergenerational and the impact of having mixed age groups together, because I think that the biggest benefit out of these co-housing projects is the bringing of people together again. They bring people together in ways that they have to work and think about the group and the benefit of the masses as opposed to the individual. And I think that's a really, really important thing, given that we've been so selfish as in more recent years and we've moved away from that village mentality. I think we're seeing a resurgence of the prevalence of that is, or the demand for that in the cities that we're now living in.
Do you have any ideas as to why there might be a bit of a resurgence?
I think it's because people are lonely, as Jane said, and people are seeking. There's so much issues with so many issues with mental health now.
Yeah.
One in four New Zealand women, men suicide rates. There's a proven issue. It's prevalent. It's talked about finally. And so now people are solutioning, you know, where there's a problem, people create solutions. And I think that's what we're starting to see.
I also think people are kind of craving authenticity, you know, and the kind of a flight back to craft and local identity of place. I think we're losing a sense of identity of who we are in our cities with hyper-globalization. So when you had, you know, property as an asset class globalized in the late 80s after the huge crash that happened in 89, and all these legal and financial mechanisms came in and we started considering homes as assets and commodities and ways to generate wealth, and that's where we kind of have this very franchised approach to housing. The source looked the same everywhere, and then you have these cookie cutter towers that are investor security deposit boxes instead of homes. So even the nomenclature we use in the industry around a product, you know, it's not, I mean, it's very commoditized. I think people genuinely crave that, they're missing that social connectedness, they're missing community. And there is like massive social isolation that's driving that mental health that Greer just mentioned. So when you engage people on the street, you know, people want to be in an urban environment, they want to be part of a community. And the other benefits, I think, of co-housing, one, it's a more effective, efficient, more sustainable cost way of living. You can rely on each other. I, too, am a huge fan of intergenerational housing. When you have kind of people in their retirement years be connected with the next generation, it gives more vitality in their retirement years. And if you have parents with young kids and you have that kind of daycare kind of and child rearing that's not just the parents' responsibility but kind of larger group, and you get more affordable child care, it's less stress on the parents. And you got to think, what's it all for? You know, I'm just buying a house to go, you know, show it off with my fancy refrigerator and marble countertops and get like a 20% return? And or is it like a place for me to raise an amazing, you know, family and really feel connected and belonging to a place? You know, that franchise approach to city making happening across the world it's really frustrating people. I mean, I travel and do this talk all over the city, and like Christchurchians are not alone. How do you guys identify yourself? You're not Christchurchians.
Cantabrians.
You're not alone. You know, every time I do a talk, I ask, you know, raise your hand if you're frustrated by the kind of development happening around you. Everyone's raised their hand for 4 years. So there's a gap in what, quote unquote, the market is delivering out there as a commodity. And what people actually want and desire. You know, I haven't heard the word co-housing used as much as I have in the last 18 months. I mean, it's a meme right now because it's that immune response. Like, we're doing it wrong and people want something different.
I would agree with that comment entirely. And I read an article today about how tricky the development market is at the moment. And yet, there's so many people who need homes and need spaces, whether it's office spaces or play spaces or any of the public areas, have all of this increased demand on them because we've got larger populations. Auckland has 850 people move here a week. And yet the property industry is saying it's so hard, we can't make it stack up. And so the supply is not meeting the demand because the property industry, traditional property industry, hasn't listened and changed what they're providing. So as a result, people are seeking to do it themselves. And you see that in Australia with their deliberate development models, the building, the housing collective, I think. And people are doing it here individually, but we just haven't got to that point of scaling it up yet. And I think that's what these conversations in Oahu development is really seeking to support and then synthesize the learning so that it can be shared and more people can take control of what it is that they actually want to produce as an outcome, whether it's co-housing or shared working spaces or...
Well, there's another really good benefit I forgot to mention. When you, because it's owner-occupied, right, and you have this kind of co-ownership and co-creation mentality, there's a lot more custodianship of place. There's a lot more care and governance, self-governance of where you live. And co-housing groups, when you kind of drop them into an existing neighborhood, tend to have this catalytic impact of community development. So people from around the neighborhood know there's a place to go in the central lounge, there's a garden maybe, kids play together. So the Murundaka, which is a co-housing cooperative in Victoria, in Heidelberg Heights, I think the statistic is like every week there's something like 200 people from around the neighborhood are always coming in and out of that place. So it really creates this really unique community generation there when you have these projects.
One that you haven't yet mentioned that I thought might have cropped up is the environmental benefits as well, rather than the sort of big urban sprawl and building further and further into brownfield, for example, greenfield even. I presume that's also something that people are starting to think more about as well, and I would imagine is being reflected a bit more in this sort of model. Would that be true?
Very much so.
I would agree with that, yeah.
And for the Viva project, our focus is on social sustainability, environmental sustainability, and financial sustainability. Of course, it all has to work financially in a project, that co-housing project that we'll be creating. So the environment is immensely important, you know, having as much environmentally sustainable principles, both within the dwellings, the homes, and within the environment, the landscape. However, in saying that, the most important is the social sustainability. Like, you could have a subdivision somewhere just out of Christchurch that is highly environmentally sustainable but has no social sustainable features. So the people could be just as lonely in those homes. And, okay, they'd be great homes to show off, Jason, like you mentioned earlier, but they could be incredibly lonely and have no connection. So it's important that what we design for the social sustainability of those communities. And there's a lot of people now, more and more people who understand about that, and you'll be one of them, Jason.
Yeah, and I think buildings being designed around people and the way they use them, unfortunately, hasn't always been that way around, with the people in the community being at the heart. And I think there's a much broader understanding of the importance of that. The environmental sustainability one's quite interesting, I think, because the notion of having smaller amounts of space and not needing an entire four-bedroom house in a quarter-acre dream, which has generally been New Zealand's housing preference, is proving to be maybe a limitation on the uptake of medium density housing and therefore a more dense co-housing model. People still have preferences around space and access to the outdoors and being able to have a barbecue. And so what I think is really interesting about the co-housing projects that we're going to see coming online in New Zealand is how you bring those preferences together in our new urban context, and how you provide through design outcomes buildings and homes that actually build social connectedness and provide for connected to the environment and connected to nature, which is something that's really important. And so how you build in environmental elements to these buildings that's not only sustainable but also relates to the type of people we are as Kiwis in New Zealand.
Yeah, look, I think all of those are important. And the interesting aspect about that, and we've touched on it at the beginning of this talk, is that if we involve people in a collaborative process from the ground up and we talk to them from the start and ask them what it is they want, they will start mentioning all those things. They'll mention the social sustainability. They'll mention the environmental sustainability. And within the Viva project, we've had over 8 integrated design workshops. And you know what? The people are saying the same things in all of those workshops. This is what we want. We want the cars to the edge of the community. We want a community space where we can gather regularly. And also the design has to be so that when people come into the community, they walk through their communal space so they have an opportunity to see the people that live within the community. And it's so heartening to hear what it is that people want rather than the top-down approach.
Yeah, I just had a dinner last night with Petersboro Co-op right here.
Cool.
They met me out on the street, walked down the driveway to this central back. They have no fences. There's gardens everywhere in the back and trees, and it's very simple and beautiful. And they had 3 picnic tables lined up, and there was a big potluck dinner, and all the families came together, the kids running around, and we had this delicious meal. And they brought out the plans, so they got their insurance money, and they're looking at doing this kind of communal living. And they've exactly what you just described is what they desire. They put the parking off to the side in the lot they bought.
Yeah.
Central garden that everyone faces out to so they can all be connected to the earth, connected to food. Kids can play and there's less stress on the mom and dad if they can see their kids safely in the courtyard instead of on the street. And then the priority of the site was put for the central lounge and amenity area where everyone can congregate for meals, play music together, cook, do the laundry, and it's designed that everyone coming in and off the site has to walk through there so you see them. That's what it's all about, being connected to each other instead of being isolated.
Yep, totally. Mm-hmm. How exciting is that?
Yeah.
Really cool. Well, that's a perfect place for our next break. Gree, we've got your song, which was Alicia Keys' New York Concrete Jungle. I presume this really needs no explanation as to why you chose it.
No.
All right, here it is. Speak Up Cord Arotea, we're speaking with Jason Twill, Jane Quigley, and Greer O'Donnell about collaborative urban housing. I thought we might do this final segment looking at the viability of this sort of model in New Zealand. We've touched already on this, but let's get into it in a bit more detail. Greer, I know you've been doing some research into some of the legal and the legislative aspects, and you mentioned particularly human rights charters, so maybe that might be a good place to start this conversation.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. Obviously, there's the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which speaks to the right to housing, but there's actually no legislative right to housing in our current political landscape. There's a number of pieces of legislation that impact and not necessarily control, but make the right to housing seem like it may be something that does exist in New Zealand, but it's not actually explicit. There are a number of means by which you can establish co-housing arrangements in New Zealand, either through private law or under trust or incorporated societies. There are a number of models, but there is not a common understanding in New Zealand about how you do that and how you pull a group of people together. I have found in the research that we've done that a lot of the legal structures rely on bespoke drafting, which makes it very unaffordable for a lot of groups. And there doesn't seem to be, you know, an off-the-shelf kind of option that you can draw down, like the Nightingale model. The Nightingale model, like, there are some issues with it in New Zealand. It can't be directly transferred to our jurisdiction, but a large part of it can. The framework can be. And I think with the work that Jane and the Viva are doing, is that I think there will soon be a model that will be easily replicable in New Zealand and easily shareable. There are some limitations around the financing arrangements in New Zealand. The banks are generally uncomfortable, even though the notion of proportional ownership and investment is well understood. There is some way to go in getting the banks and the financing companies to be less fearful around this community-led deliberative co-ownership models and proportional ownership models. So it's a large part about translating our aspirational language into the existing language that lawyers and bankers and property developers use while we go through this process of shifting from these more speculative models to community-led models.
Look, it's great that you talked about the aspirations, because it was the aspirations that Viva was formed from. You know, we didn't go and look at any legislation that said, well, how can we have this? We probably would have been daunted before we even started. But, you know, like, it's involving a team of people. Like, we've used our lawyer, Karen Overend, a lot to be guided into, you know, what we can do. So basically we tell her, well, this is what we want, and then she finds the pathway to create
That's
it.
Right.
And I just totally believe that if people are committed and passionate enough, there will be a way. And people have done it around the world too. And, you know, like, for goodness sake, this isn't a new model, as we've all talked about. It's, you know, it's centuries old, people living in villages, for goodness sake.
I think it's really interesting, though. Yeah, there's a co-housing network globally. You know, they genuinely want to support each other. Like Nightingale, we all support each other through the legal mechanisms, the investment perspectives. How do you engage people on this discussion? So we're all supporting each other, and it's a co-learning community. You can't talk about co-housing without mentioning Charles Durrett, Chuck Durrett, and his, you know, Jane's got the book right in front of us. He's been a global, you know, supporter of this and been very helpful in getting groups off the ground all over the world. And you call any person focusing on legal issues for co-housing, financial ones, and they're very open in helping share how they got through that process, how they dealt with that issue. So it's a very open community, open source community. How that manifests on the ground, locally in the context of New Zealand law, regulatory environments, can be worked through. I'm less concerned about the legal financial mechanisms. I'm more concerned about how modern humans relate to land. Meaning the biggest issue we have on every city on the earth right now is that when you look at land as a commodity, It's a finite resource. And when you have hundreds of thousands of people competing for the same space in a concentrated area for places to learn, play, work, and live, you put tremendous pressure on that land. And cities have not done a good job at tempering land value inflation, which is underpinning everything around the inaffordability of cities, from food, supply chain, housing, everything, which pushes us out farther from the urban core, which makes it more expensive to put infrastructure in, more expensive to move around, more expensive to get goods and services. So that is a fundamental paradigm shift of how we look at land. And the mechanisms that are working really well in Europe and the U.S., which I shared the other night, is a community land trust, where you actually take the land component out of the deal. It's non-speculative. Cooperative ownership of land is a common good. And how do we look at land and be custodians of land? This is where we learn from indigenous peoples of the world and the way that they look at themselves in relation to land and ecology, that we belong to the earth. You know, when modern Western humans start to understand that relationship and living within the means of our planet, financially, ecologically, and socially, then we start to unlock the potential for these models to grow tremendously. There's about 270 community land trusts in the United States, some of which have over 5,000 units on them, and they're permanent affordable housing, permanent affordable businesses. Create tremendous diversity and inclusion for the places that they're created in. So there's some underlying things that governments need to take bold leadership on and start to create interventions for their cities and enable enable Viva to happen.
Yep.
Right here in Christchurch.
Woo-hoo.
You have a group of people here wanting this. You know, government needs to be an enabler of these kind of these housing models.
Well, that brings me to a really interesting point, and that's the unfortunate failure of the BREATHE project to get off the ground. And why on earth did that not succeed, I think, is a really, really big and very disappointing question.
That's right. And actually, Jason, I'd love to talk about that. Jason talked about asking people, as he's been travelling around the world, if they're frustrated with the housing, you know, that we've got in the cities. And I put my hand up at his talk, but, you know, actually, people in Christchurch are more than frustrated. You know, like, we're incredibly annoyed about what happened around the BREATHE project. And, look, we'd love to see it brought to life again. There were over 60 international entries for the BREATHE project from many, many places around the world. Egypt, you know, just Germany, the UK, just to mention a few. And I personally, along with my team, put in hours and hours and hours and hours of work. You know, barely went to bed before 12 o'clock as I worked on you know, some of the visions of what we wanted in our plans, and then to have the whole thing scrapped, how devastating was that? Absolutely.
And I would just like to build on that. I mean, from somebody on the inside, on the government side, I'd just like to touch on two points that Jason raised around the treatment of land and how we view land and the leadership required by government. And in both those instances, the government failed because the requirement for a return on the land, even if indirectly, remained, and the leadership in taking a hit was missing. So the government was still trying to act like a commercial entity instead of leading by example in terms of taking the commodity out of land.
And that's not unique to Christchurch either.
No, and it's a lack of the institution understanding what's required. You know, they're kind of always last to the party. And that project failed because it came down to project viability and a lack of political will to take a risk.
Yeah.
And so I think,
or even just a longer term view of things. I think
that's right.
You're right, because government will typically use the same analysis that the private sector will use to get a return on government property, which in all intents and purposes is the people's property.
Yep.
It's owned by the government, it's owned by us.
Yep.
So if they're using highest and best use analysis, they're going to come to the same conclusion that a developer will, because it's going to, I can get the most profit by doing luxury apartment housing on this site. Mm. But what does that do to your economy? What does that do to the people for blood, sweat, and tears and third-generation businesses that have been in this community for 30 years that get displaced by that? What does it do to... there's a multiplier negative impact of that kind of analysis. And government needs to be a steward of the people. It should be looking at highest and critical use. They should understand housing is economic infrastructure for the vitality and their competitiveness and be able to keep the very people in their city that make their city function and work. The bus drivers, the teachers, the nurses, people who work at human rights radio stations and raise kids here. what are cities for if not for everybody? If it's only for the highest end part of the market, I have this theory, the way that the industry is structured in delivering cities, it's causing this kind of wankerization of cities, because when everything's left, Mayor Hidalgo of Paris has a really great term. We're creating the new ghettos of the future, ghettos of the rich.
Mm.
Right? So everyone else gets priced out.
Yeah. So look, moving forward with Christchurch, let's have some transparency. Like we've talked about it here in this interview, like some transparency. That's what people want, like moving forward within the city. We've got over 600 people on the Viva database. And while not all of them want to necessarily live in a co-housing community, they're people that want to see this kind of living happen. You know, they want to be part of it, even if they don't want to live there. Like, how cool is that? Mm-hmm. Mm. And it's very inspiring.
I guess one thing that might be holding people back as well is that sort of the mentality of owning your own home, having the quarter-acre dream. We've spoken about those before, but also this idea perhaps of, if it's a co-space, how is it all equitably divided, I suppose? How often do you get to use the barbecue? Who has young kids who might be doing some babysitting? Those sorts of more social equitability discussions, I suppose. Have you noticed that in any of your work, that sort of barrier has been surfacing, perhaps?
I think this goes to a point that's in Razulia around the characteristics of people, and especially modern day people, and the notion of working together and considering others is something that we need to remind ourselves of, and is being really thoroughly explored through these projects. The eco village Dalier is up in the Whanganui River. I went and talked to them, and they had some really, really interesting observations about their eco village, and it was all around human nature. And actually the biggest challenges they faced weren't the legal structures or the financial structures. They could figure that out, like you guys have mentioned before, you just work it out, you find a pathway. But actually the how decisions were made and how you solve conflict and how you prioritize without hierarchy and how you move through disagreement. And so they've set up lots of mechanisms to work through each of those things instead of being prescriptive. So they kind of agree to principles of how they want to live together. So they want to be able for everybody to participate, and they want fairness, and they want, the majority needs to rule, except for on these particular areas where actually one dissenter is not acceptable. And so they've built these quite, not necessarily complex, but they've been really thought out, even though they may now appear simple, like card systems where you have a card that says, green for go, orange for middle of the road on that, red for no, and then a black card, which is I absolutely just can't cope with whatever this decision is.
Deal breaker.
And they have sort of rules around it, just those cards and what they mean, and then what happens when they're raised in groups. And it's this fascinating experiment around human behaviour and how, even though they have all of the best of intentions and they have chosen to live in a communal arrangement, and yet they still have conflict and challenges in that space.
Look, it's really great that there's a number of models. What comes to mind with what you're saying to Greer is Earth Song in Auckland, and they use that model too. And Jason mentioned the Creating Co-Housing book, which I have here in front of me. They also talk about how to manage, I guess, the human behaviour aspect. And, yeah, like these are important. And give us an opportunity, that's what I say.
Yeah. That's not all perfect. Humans are a strange species. We're all very different personalities. When you bring 40 people together and you're a bit more exposed, then, you know, human behavior changes. But there's cooperative governance models that have been tried and tested across hundreds of different co-housing developments, and every group has to self-organize a bit and do what works for them. But it builds character. You deal with conflict resolution in a much more amicable way. Yes, there's been some fights going on in co-housing. Yes, there's some personalities that people get probably pushed out of a community, but you're never going to not, it's never going to be perfect all the time. But the fact that there's self-governance and equity put into it, it gets into this kind of, for how many decades have we been sold this dream of having an isolated home with a backyard and a fence, and that's how you have to do it if you're going to be a normal modern human. So it gets into the kind of the neurobiology of modern humans about me maps in our brains. And there were no moving back from me to we. And I think there's that global kind of mentality of how we get that we mentality back, so we all kind of share in what's happening around us. What I love in all the co-housing projects I've visited around the world, the children that grew up there, right, that they're just kind of floating around. They have all these great adults, you know, and there's always a chalkboard on the wall of who's got the responsibilities. If I stay as a guest, I'm always in the kitchen cooking with people, and it's just great, you know, that we're all sharing resources, sharing responsibilities. And when someone's slagging, they're going to let you know about it. And they get off their butt and they do it.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm really lucky. I live in a what Jason talked about is a co-living environment. I've got five houses and I rent to internationals. So I live in a group with 47 other people. So, you know, like, we handle that stuff. We have people not cleaning the kitchens.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, what I've had to develop is listening skills. Okay, you just come over here and we'll have a talk about it. So, but, you know, like, I love it. I love being surrounded by that many people. How cool is that? How cool is my life?
Mm-hmm.
Or my business. Yeah. It's my business. Yeah.
I think I'm in my early 30s, and for my generation, lots of the groups that I've been talking with all say, you know, oh, well, how do we share money if we're going to develop it together? And they're inherently distrustful of other people, and they assume that, you know, people are going to be out to be self-interested. And it's actually getting that shift from these people, from the way that we've viewed collaboration and shifting towards a more trust-based, regenerative, we're going to create something together and we're all going to benefit from that. And we're not out for the individual self. And there is definitely a certain demand that exists, but I think we're seeing more and more people who are probably more traditional in their views coming to the party out of a needs basis, because they can't, even though they're all young professionals with well-paying jobs, they can't afford to buy a house in Auckland, and they can't afford to even rent a house in any of the inner suburbs. So they're looking at seeking what, well, is there another option, and they're coming together in groups saying, well, yes, we can do this together, but how we do that? So it's almost we're starting to convert the unconverted, and with that comes the need to step them through how we go about dealing with all those human characteristics.
Yeah. Chuck will tell you, read his book.
That's a great book.
Well, just my final question for you then. Are you guys feeling optimistic about the future of these co-housing projects?
I'm feeling totally optimistic. I'm feeling really excited. And I just get over the week, you know, we've had a few, there was a Housing Matters Forum in the council function room last Friday, and people are coming together to talk about how can we have residential living within the four avenues of Christchurch. And there's a real optimism and a now about this happening. So I'm really excited, actually. Yeah.
Great.
Mm. Yeah, I'm super optimistic. I mean, I think if you look at across the world, the movement's growing. It's scaling and expanding, and it's getting momentum. Mm. And that I see is also a huge generational shift in thinking, attitudes, and behaviors about what kind of life people want. Mm. And the Gen X, Gen Y, millennials, measuring success very differently than our parents did, not so much around wealth, but on experience. I think you have a much more socially conscious generation coming up behind us, either probably because they're just connected to all the world's issues through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And they want something more meaningful in life. I think they're craving not just like, I'm going to be an investment banker and make a whole bunch of money and get a boat and be really sad and take drugs and get divorced and like the recipe for the last generation pretty much. But there's this more meaning, how do we have more meaning in life? How do we get more connected? How are we going to solve probably the biggest issues our species have ever faced?
Yep.
The ecological and social crises that we're dealing with that we've created for ourselves.
Mm. I think more and more people are asking, how can I make a difference?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Definitely seeking meaning and purposefulness, and not only the way that they work, but in the way that they live. And I think because of that, I'm not only optimistic, but I'm really confident, and I'm just excited to see it all come to fruition because it's all bubbling away and we just need a couple of these projects to get a bit of profile, and I think we'll see real momentum really quickly in New Zealand.
That's a really, really great upbeat vibe to finish on. So I'd like to say kia ora. Thank you very much, all of you, for taking the time. It's been a really great discussion. If you're listening to this, don't forget you can check out our Facebook and Twitter accounts. We'll stick up some of the resources we've been discussing. And also there's a transcript available as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.